You know those devices that are supposed to automatically give you a squirt of soap when you're at the sink in a public restroom somewhere? In 2017, a video went viral that showed a guy with dark skin trying to use one of these. When he waves his hand in front of the sensor, nothing happens. Then he holds up a white paper towel in front of it and presto, soap. Tries his hand again, nothing. Whether or not anybody intended to make what turned out to be a racially biased soap dispenser, this technology was built and sold without anybody thinking to test it to see whether it worked as well for people of color as for white people. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. This seems to be an example of how technology can fail us, but as my guest will explain, the real failure here lies with our unquestioning faith in technology to be neutral and beneficial. Unless human designers are deliberate and really careful about this, technologies and algorithms created by a small and often privileged segment of the population will learn from previous human bias and oversight and contribute to inequality in surprising and, frankly, depressing ways. Meredith Broussard is associate professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University and research director at the NYU Alliance for Public Interest Technology. Her book is called More Than a Glitch: Confronting Race, Gender, and Ability Bias in Tech. Meredith, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
The concern that animates this book is that we have embraced techno-chauvinism. What does that term mean?
Techno-chauvinism is a kind of bias that says that technological solutions are superior to others. And what I would argue is that it's not a competition, that we just need to use the right tool for the task. And sometimes the right tool for the task is, in fact, a computer. And sometimes it's something simple like a book in the hands of a child sitting on a parent's lap. You know, one is not inherently better than the other.
What is the difference between mathematical fairness, which computers and algorithms can reliably deliver, and social fairness, which they can't?
Well, I start the book with a story about the difference between different kinds of fairness, and that starts with a cookie. So when I was a kid, and there would be just one cookie left in the cookie jar in the kitchen, my little brother and I would fight over who got the cookie. And if you were a computer trying to solve this, you would say, well, each child gets 50% of the cookie. And that would be absolutely correct. That is a mathematically fair decision. But in the real world, when you divide a cookie, there is a big half and a little half.
Right.
And so if I wanted the big half, I would say to my brother, okay, listen, you give me the big half now, and I will let you decide the TV show that we watch after dinner. And my brother would think for a second and he would say, yeah, that sounds fair. And it was. It was a socially fair decision, right? So we are accustomed to making these kinds of trade-offs. You know, we accept that there are some things that need to be mathematically fair. There are other things that need to be socially fair. And we need to not get confused and not imagine that computers, which are math machines, are going to be able to solve social problems or solve for social fairness.
How does it happen, Meredith, that we so often end up minimizing the problems that technology not just doesn't solve, but can create? Why do we assume everything that ails us can be easily fixed with a little update to the code?
Well, the title of the book is More Than a Glitch, because the glitch is this this kind of temporary blip. Right. And we kind of say, oh, yeah, well, the algorithm to detect welfare fraud is, is not working. Must be a glitch. It must be something that's easy to fix. And what I'm arguing is that we need to go beyond that. We need to stop imagining that we can fix every problem with code. And we need to come up with solutions that are both social and technical. So I'm not saying get rid of computers. That would be crazy. But I am saying let's acknowledge that these are really difficult social problems that do not have an easy technological fix.
They don't even have an easy social fix. I mean, the example that I mentioned in my introduction, which came from the book, is really interesting because we don't need to assume the people who designed these soap dispensers intended to do anything bad, right? We don't need to assume that they intended to deny soap to people with darker skin. But it's really telling. It simply didn't occur to them to realize what could go wrong.
And this happens all the time. I absolutely do not think that there was malicious intent by the people who made the racist soap dispenser. I think they were probably a group of people with light skin because, you know, that's who's dominant in the tech industry. And they tested it on themselves and they tested it on their friends and family and said, oh, works for us, must work for everybody. And it's a really good example of unconscious bias and how that manifests inside technological systems. Because we all have unconscious bias. We're all trying to become better people every day, but we're not there yet. And because our biases are unconscious, we can't see them. And so they're very difficult to spot inside our technologies. One really easy solution is to have diverse teams of people creating technology so that you have people with, say, a range of skin tones in the room. But you see over and over again that these kinds of problems manifest in technology. For example, facial recognition systems that are better at recognizing light skin than dark skin. They're better at recognizing men than women. We have things like self-driving cars that are better at recognizing light skin than dark skin. We have the case of the Amazon resume sorting algorithm that selected for people who were already successful at the company, which was, you know, largely, men of a paler hue, and the algorithm just kicked out all the women, right? Hmm. So people, like small homogeneous groups of people making technology, have collective blind spots, and we need to design differently because we recognize that now.
Okay, so the problem of machine bias starts with machine learning. How does machine learning use data collected in the past to make predictions about the future?
One of the things I've run into a lot is the idea that we use the terms AI and machine learning indiscriminately. And so one of the things I do in the book is I get really detailed, but use plain language about what do I mean by machine learning? All right, so machine learning is a process where you take a whole bunch of data, you feed it into the computer, and you say, computer, make me a model. And the computer says, okay. And it makes a model that articulates the mathematical patterns in the data. And then you can use that model to make predictions. So ChatGPT is the machine learning system that people are talking a lot about now. ChatGPT takes in 570 gigabytes of data and makes a mathematical model of the patterns. And then you can use it to predict the next word in a sentence, right? It is a large language model. It takes in patterns from the past and makes new patterns, right? All machine learning works like this. So there is something that happened where people started to believe that because we could use computers to find these patterns, that this was our salvation. And what I'm arguing in the book is that we need to complicate that a little bit. We need to not blindly trust in our machines to somehow be better than humans, because humans have our own frailties.
How can machines find and act on correlations between factors that might steer us to the wrong conclusions when, say, we ask a computer to help determine who ought to qualify for a bank loan?
The bank loan issue is one that I focus on a lot because I think this is really instructive. So the markup which is an algorithmic accountability journalism organization, did a study a little while ago about mortgage approval algorithms. And what they found was that mortgage approval algorithms are 40 to 80% more likely to deny loan applicants of color than their white counterparts. Now, the reason for this is that the data that was fed into the system, again, it's a machine learning system, so fed in data, made a model, made decisions like in the past, the data is biased. Because what do we have in the United States? We have a very long history of financial discrimination. We have a very long history of residential segregation. So the people who have gotten mortgages in the past tend not to be people of color. And so the machine just looks at the data and says, oh, we're just going to keep going that way.
You explain in the book that cognitive shortcuts are tested by situations that don't fit neatly into existing mental models, situations you call edge cases. How does it happen that humans are often so much better at dealing with edge cases than computers are?
I think the easiest way to think about it is to think about new situations. So a computer is fed with data up until a certain point. So the only frame of reference it has is everything that has happened in its little computational data world up until that point. But stuff happens after that, right? And so humans are really good at looking at new situations and drawing conclusions and incorporating that new data into their mental models. And the computational model is frozen in time. So I think about the way that I have changed my mind, that I have grown over the course of my life. And I don't think you would want the 12-year-old version of me to make decisions about today, right? So we don't necessarily want the computational models that are, you know, based on ideas from years ago to make decisions about today, because society changes. We update our own mindsets and our computational systems need to evolve too.
Meredith, how does a social construct like race get embedded into computational systems as if it's a scientific fact?
I started thinking about this when I looked at my own medical records. So as a Black woman with a white parent, I often check multiple boxes when I have to fill out a form. And when I was a kid, there would only ever be boxes for white or Black or other. And I was annoyed that you could only pick one thing. Now you can pick multiple things and there are more options, which is great. But when I look at my medical records, I will sometimes have tests run for somebody who is African American ancestry and somebody who is of white ancestry. And I thought this was kind of normal. I didn't think about it very much because you don't really think about your own medical records that much. Until I started doing this project and I started digging into the history of race in medicine. And I discovered that the social construct of race is embedded in our diagnostics in a number of really potentially dangerous ways and very unfair ways. So for example, until recently, there was a formula that determined when you got onto the kidney transplant list. And that meant when your EGFR score, your estimated glomerular filtration rate score, was 20 or below, then you would be eligible for the kidney transplant list. And you'd kind of wait for a, you know, donor kidney who matched you to show up. Now, the formula that calculated EGFR was race-based. So there was one formula for Black people, and there was another formula for everybody who was not Black. And if you were listed as Black, you would get a multiplier 1.2 to 1.8, and your score would be calculated differently. The effect of this was that Black people would not qualify for the kidney transplant list as quickly. They had to be sicker in order to be eligible for a donor kidney, which is obviously completely unfair. And I give a lot of credit to the advocates, primarily patients, who have advocated for changing this formula. But the problem is when you make a medical system, when you make a computational system based on a racist formula like this, the problematic formula then gets embedded in the computational system. It becomes impossible to see and very, very difficult to eradicate. So when the kidney formula changed a year or so ago, all of the labs in the entire world had to update their computer systems. I had to update the way they calculated things. Has that happened effectively? I'm not sure.
I want to go back. You mentioned facial recognition software. These days, law enforcement officials have access not just to arrest photos in a database, but also increasingly to millions of images of faces captured, like when people go to get a driver's license or an official ID. When are the algorithms that draw from these photos likely to be wrong in making a positive match, or more likely to be wrong?
All the time.
Okay.
One of the situations I wrote about in the book is a case of a man in Michigan who was arrested and put in jail because of a faulty match by facial recognition. We have a number of these cases now. Facial recognition has been found to work better on light skin than on dark skin. It works better on men than on women. It works best of all on men with light skin. It works worst of all on women with dark skin. And trans and non-binary folks tend to not be in the training data for facial recognition at all. It is not a good idea to deploy these technologies in policing until or unless they work for everybody. And I mean, in the case of facial recognition, I would argue that we shouldn't be using it in policing at all, full stop.
Let's talk about that. I know some people say this can be fixed if we just fix the problems that currently exist with correctly identifying Black and brown people in particular. Why do you feel like it's better just to stop using these systems for those purposes?
This is a really common response, the idea that, okay, well, you're saying that the system is intersectionally inaccurate, so let's just put in better data and we'll have a better system. And yes, that's absolutely true. But in a case like facial recognition in policing, it doesn't actually help us to make the system more accurate. Because technologies like facial recognition are disproportionately weaponized against communities of color. And so we're not actually getting ourselves toward a better world if we use the strategy of using ever more punitive surveillance technology.
We've all heard, Meredith, about concerns over bias in standardized testing. How were algorithms used in the spring of 2020 to decide which students would qualify for IB high school credits upon graduation without a single student actually sitting for those exams that year?
Oh, it's horrifying, isn't it? So I was particularly bothered when I heard the story because I'm a professor. And one of the things that I really care about in my classroom is I care about my students' learning. I feel good about the fact that, no matter where you are, where you start when you come into my classroom, I can get you further along your learning journey, right? And what I found out was that the International Baccalaureate exam, the IB exam, which is this international alternative high school diploma, was using an algorithm to assign imaginary grades to real students. So ordinarily, IB program ends at the end of your senior year with a bunch of tests, and then you qualify for the IB diploma based on the tests. And if you get high enough scores on the tests, you can get college credits. So this is really great for students who are struggling to pay for college. You can get an entire year of college paid for sometimes if you get good enough scores on these IB exams. So, major stepping stone for economic growth, especially for lower income students. But what happened was the algorithm predicted the imaginary grades for the real students, and it predicted that poor students would do badly on the tests and rich students would do well on the tests. Now, why was IB doing this? It was because it was the pandemic. And yeah, we all made a lot of emergency technological decisions during the pandemic, but this really stood out for me as an example of not thinking ahead and not understanding what are the patterns in the data. Because if you know anything about school statistics, you know that there's a correlation between poverty and and school success. The rich kids tend to do better in school than the poor kids. And that is something that we need to address as a society. And we absolutely should not be using algorithms to say, oh yeah, if you are a kid from a particular background, you're never going anywhere.
Meredith, lots of people are excited about the potential for assistive technologies to allow people with disabilities to reach their full potential and, go as far as they can in their careers. You share the story here of a man named Richard Dahan who had a very different experience. Will you tell us about him?
Sure. I had to learn the most for this chapter of the book. I felt like I knew a fair bit about the way that racism works, the way that sexism works, but I knew the least about disability and about accessibility and assistive technologies. So I'm really grateful to the folks who shared their wisdom with me for the research for this part of the book. And accessible technology has given people with disabilities wonderful opportunities. So I really embrace technology for accessibility. And what I want to do is I want to push the conversation a little bit further to say, all right, the technology is not everything. So I met Richard Dahan, who is someone who used to work at an Apple store in Maryland. He's deaf, and people would come from all over in order to visit him at the Apple store because he could communicate with customers in ASL, American Sign Language. And so lots of deaf customers came. It was great, but he started getting a hard time from a manager who said, oh, you're not keeping up in the daily meeting. And Richard said, all right, well, the problem is that I've asked for an interpreter. So that I can participate more in the meetings because the technological solution wasn't working well enough. We have speech to text, it's terrific. We have systems where like a human aide will come in and type what's going on in a meeting or in a class. I've had that in a lot of my classes. That's a really good system. But it's very hard for, say, your coworker to type notes on an iPad or a computer about what's going on in a meeting and then also participate in the meeting. So the technology that Richard was offered as an accommodation was not doing everything he needed it to do. So Richard asked for a human interpreter. The human interpreter was not given because they said, oh, the technology is going to be enough, right? This kind of situation happens a lot for folks who are disabled. People want to just throw technology at the problem and then just not, not do more. We need to do more. We need to listen to disabled people who are saying, this is what I need. And we also need to not imagine that there's one size fits all approach to disability.
You share a story here of challenging yourself, a human professor, to be a better teacher to your visually impaired students. Talk about how you realized you needed to do this and how it really made you a better teacher for all students.
So as a teacher, you typically get an alert before the semester begins if you have a student who needs accommodations in your class. And every time that happens, like I am, absolutely willing to make those accommodations, not just because it is my legal responsibility, but also because it is a moral responsibility. I want my students to, to feel included in the classroom. And every time this has happened, it's forced me to learn a little bit as an instructor. And one of the things that happened was I was teaching a class on data visualization, and a student who's blind signed up for the data visualization class. I thought, all right, well, I don't really know what to do here. Let me ask the, the folks at Disability Services. And I did, and they kind of looked at me like, what? And so I looked into it further, and it turns out that there actually aren't that many resources for teaching data visualization to students who are blind. The visualization software itself is not, is not really designed for accessibility. Now, since then, there have been a lot of advances. And now we have, more options in terms of alt text being available. And we have better kind of standardized practices for describing charts and tables. Things have changed. Especially since that moment when a few years ago, when I was trying to figure this out. And so I also had an opportunity to kind of learn and grow when I had a different student who was blind in a different class. And I had to figure out how to, how to get them the slides that I was using. I was using PowerPoint slides as part of the lecture. And I asked the, the folks at Disability Services, okay, what do I do? How can I be better about this? And they said, well, one of the things you can do is you can read out loud what's on your slides. I realized, oh, well, actually, I haven't been reading what's on my slides because I had been told at a public speaking class, 20 odd years ago, that you shouldn't read your slides. You should let people read the slides themselves and you should talk about something different. So I read the slides out loud and it worked better. And I made the slides available on the learning management system for all the students. Guess what? It wasn't just good for the student who was blind, but it was good for everybody. So there are lots of ways that designing practices for accessibility and updating our own habits for greater accessibility can benefit everybody.
There's no question that some of the problems we've talked about today might be prevented or corrected if we had worked to ensure greater diversity among tech developers. But you also think we need to accept that sometimes computers will be the best tools for what we want to get done, and sometimes they will not. What kinds of questions do we need to ask in order to know when computers might contribute to existing problems or create new ones rather than solve them?
I'm hesitant to give a to give kind of universal sweeping pronouncements about this because I feel like it depends on the context. One of the things that I am optimistic about in terms of policy is I'm really optimistic about the way that the EU is thinking about artificial intelligence regulation. So, in the proposed EU AI regulation, they divide artificial intelligence into high risk and low risk uses. So, like a low risk use of facial recognition might be using facial recognition to unlock your phone. Nothing is at stake there. There's a passcode. If the facial recognition doesn't work, it's not a big deal. But a high risk use of facial recognition might be police using facial recognition on real-time video surveillance feeds, right? There's lots of possibility for error. Lots of possibility for disparate impact. So the high risk use would have to be registered, regulated, and monitored, right? So I am excited about more conversations about the context in which we use AI or the context in which we use technology. And I would love to see people make more deliberate choices.
Meredith Broussard is Associate Professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute of New York University and Research Director at the NYU Alliance for Public Interest Technology. Her newest book is called More Than a Glitch: Confronting Race, Gender, and Ability Bias in Tech. Meredith, thanks very much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great talking with you.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think, or use that search term wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to ours. You can also listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.